It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Ukraine restores military draft as pro-Russian pressure mounts in the east. Suspected terrorist blast kills 15 in Nigerian suburb. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. Ukraine has restored military conscription to deal with increasingly violent pro-Russian separatists who have seized buildings in about a dozen cities in Ukraine's Russian-speaking east. Interim President Alexander Turchynov signed this conscription decree Thursday, just hours after Russian President Vladimir Putin demanded that Ukraine withdraw all military personnel from the troubled region near the Russian border. Mr. Putin made the demand in a phone conversation with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who meets with U.S. President Barack Obama later today in Washington. Russia's Interfax news agency said Mr. Putin also stressed the need for a broad national dialogue in Ukraine involving all regions and political forces. A car bomb killed at least 15 people late Thursday at a bus terminal on the outskirts of the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The blast was near the site of an April 14th bombing at a bus station that killed at least 75 people. The Islamic extremist group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the April blast, known as Claim Responsibility for the latest attack. Nigeria is planning to host the World Economic Forum on Africa next week. President Goodluck Jonathan has promised extraordinary security measures for the meeting. He said Nigeria will triumph over what he calls the evil that wants to debase humanity. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States supports African-led efforts to combat the most deadly conflicts of the continent. He said Thursday during his visit to Addis Ababa that many nations are at risk of descending into broad-based violence.
It is clear that the unspeakable violence in the Central African Republic, the deliberate killing of civilians on both sides in South Sudan, both of those underscore the urgency of the work that we have to do together.
Kerry visited the African Union's headquarters in the Ethiopian capital for talks with officials on the CAR, where Muslims continue to flee their homes to escape attacks by Christian militia. Earlier Thursday, he met with the foreign ministers of Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya to discuss the challenges of how to get South Sudan's warring sides to halt their months of deadly fighting. The top diplomats agreed that South Sudan needs a legitimate force to help stabilize the country. Turkish police fired tear gas and water cannon against demonstrators across Turkey as thousands of people marched around the world to mark International Workers' Day, also known as May Day. In Istanbul, Turkey, police clashed with protesters attempting to reach Taksim Square, the usual site of May Day rallies. 1 year ago, the massive May Day demonstrations grew into a huge anti-government movement. At least 50 people were injured and around 140 detained in Istanbul and the capital, Ankara. In other May Day commemorations, Russian workers marched on Moscow's Red Square in a patriotic display. The parades on Red Square were the first since May Day demonstrations ceased at the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. Rallies also took place across Asia. Thousands of workers and activists took to the streets of Manila to demand wage increases amid rising living costs. Thailand says new elections will be held July 20th to try to end months of political deadlock, but the main opposition party says it has not decided whether it will participate. VOA's Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
The main opposition Democrat Party says another election is not feasible under present conditions. Party spokesman Chavanon Tarakamalyasut tells VOA the government needs to agree to implement reforms for the Democrats to participate in polling.
I don't see that we can have the free and fair election. We are afraid that the upcoming election, if it could ever happen on July 20, is going to be the same as what happened February 2nd.
The Democrats boycotted that election, and anti-government protesters blockaded enough polling stations to invalidate the vote. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Iraqi election officials are counting ballots Thursday after the country's first general election since U.S. troops withdrew in 2011. For more on these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations says separation and segregation are not the solution to the crisis in the Central African Republic.
As a result of their experience of the violence, they're overtaken by fear. They're also being radicalized and manipulated by the different leaderships to believe that a solution is segregation and separation.
John Geng is humanitarian director for the UN mission in the Central African Republic. The Obama administration is again challenged for its handling of the 2012 Benghazi embassy attack. A former Kenyan prime minister criticizes the current government for its Somali refugees policy. And a Malawian group warns of possible electoral problems as the country goes to the polls on May 20th.
The first concern was the registration process itself. The second concern is to do with the voter verification exercise.
Voice Umhoni is the leader of Malawi's Civil Society Grand Coalition. The families of kidnapped Nigerian girls protest to demand their rescue. Conflicts in Africa lead to more violence against journalists, and West and Central Africa are lagging in HIV care. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and Our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A senior UN humanitarian official warned on Thursday that separating Muslims and Christians in the Central African Republic is not the solution to the country's intercommunal violence. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
John Ging, the operations director for the UN's humanitarian division, said the country's minority Muslims feel trapped and want to be evacuated from their neighborhoods because they feel threatened by Christian self-defense militias.
It has resulted in the segregation and separation of communities. People are now overtaken, you know, as a result of their experience of the violence, they're overtaken by fear. They're also being radicalized and manipulated by the different leaderships to believe that a solution is segregation and separation.
Ging was recently in the CAR on his second mission there in the past 3 months. He said the situation is continuing to deteriorate at an alarming rate. Nearly 1 million people have been displaced by the violence between mainly Christian anti-Balaka militias attacking Muslim Seleka rebels. Seleka forces overthrew the government just over a year ago. The UN says more than half the country's population is in need of aid. Ging said that humanitarians have had to help thousands of civilians evacuate in Bosangoa, Bangui, and elsewhere because they were under threat from anti-Balaka fighters. In one town he visited, Boda, he said there were 24,000 Muslims appealing for evacuation. In a sign of the intercommunal tensions, he said some Christian leaders were also encouraging the UN to help the Muslims leave.
This is the ugly dynamic, the ugly face to this conflict, where the intolerance, the incapacity for dialogue, attempts at dialogue between the communities in Boda have failed so far. Now, needless to say, this is not the solution.
Ging pointed out that the Central African Republic has a long history of religious tolerance among its communities, and with help from the international community, could stop the violence. The UN will be sending a force of nearly 12,000 peacekeepers to the country in mid-September. Until then, about 8,000 French and African personnel are trying to stem the violence and protect civilians. The European Union has also deployed about 1,000 soldiers, but the UN Secretary General has appealed for more. In addition to insecurity, the country is facing massive humanitarian challenges. Despite appeals to donors, the UN Fund for Central African Republic is less than one-third funded, and there are shortages of food, medicines, and other life-saving supplies. The situation will likely become more dire now that the rainy season has begun. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The Obama administration is facing challenges from the opposition and the news media on its handling of the 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, which killed 4 Americans, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
At issue is a newly released email from 2012 that critics say bolsters their claim the administration tried to deflect blame for the incident by falsely saying the attack was triggered by a video that insulted Islam. In that email, the administration lays out talking points that then United Nations Ambassador Susan Rice was to follow when she appeared on television news shows to explain the incident. The email was written by White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes and said the administration's goal was to underscore that the protests taking place at various diplomatic posts at the time were rooted in the video. Later, U.S. officials confirmed the attack at the consulate in Benghazi was the result of an organized terrorist plot. In a heated exchange with reporters that extended from Wednesday to Thursday, White House spokesman Jay Carney accused the opposition of politicizing the Benghazi attack.
This administration's focus since that event has been on pursuing those did harm to Americans, who killed Americans, and bringing them to justice, and taking action to ensure that the failures in security that helped cause this or lead to this event were addressed and changed. What we have seen since hours after the attack, beginning with a statement by the Republican nominee for president, is an attempt by Republicans to politicize a tragedy. And that continues today and yesterday.
Administration officials say the email was discussing the wider incidents in which demonstrators held violent protests outside several U.S. diplomatic facilities in the region. The administration released the email only after a lawsuit demanding the handover of all emails related to the Benghazi incident, fueling further criticism among those who accused the administration of covering up or downplaying the attack. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
The Malawi Civil Society Grand Coalition says the failure of the Electoral Commission to address concerns expressed by political parties could undermine the May 20th general election. The Grand Coalition also expressed worries that the continued use of state resources by President Joyce Banda's ruling People's Party during the campaign period could potentially lead to electoral disputes. Voice Umhoni, leader of the Grand Coalition, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the Electoral Commission has yet to resolve problems associated with the voter list, which it is compiling for the May 20th vote.
We have several concerns that are to do with electoral processes as we go towards May 20th, 2014 for the polls. The first concern was the registration process itself. The second concern is to do with the voter verification exercise. The other issue is the trying to level the playing ground. Both state-controlled media and private media, they are up to now showing some biases, they are reported. And therefore, the ground is not leveled enough. The other thing is that the ruling party is using state resources to do its campaign. And we have seen that it's only the president who is campaigning across the country, and she's using the state resources.
Have you officially petitioned the Malawi Electoral Commission about these concerns that you just enumerated?
Normally, every month, we have the National Electoral Consultative Forum, and all concerns are filed there. And much of the concerns have been coming from political parties, more especially those in the opposition. On top of that, the Grand Coalition is being supported by its own member, Malawi Electoral Support Network. That's a network of NGOs, faith-based organizations that looks at the electoral processes. And the leadership of that network have had several meetings with Malawi Electoral Commission.
Where do you draw the line between state resources being used by the president to campaign? Because the president is still the president of the country and she needs to campaign.
The challenge is that probably in Malawi we have been calling for transparency on the resources, public resources, and the transparency on how political parties are financed, both opposition as well as the government. This has not come forth up to now. And indeed, the president cannot jump into a bus to go to campaign. But if you look at the way the resources are being used, we still have the state media following her up wherever she is, and the covering and the broadcasting the so-called developmental rallies, while clearly they seem to be political rallies.
Voice Umhoni is the leader of Malawi's Civil Society Grand Coalition. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 2nd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. A former Kenyan prime minister and leader of the Quad opposition says the current government was high-handed in its recent crackdown on Somali refugees in Kenya. Raila Odinga says the rounding up of Somali refugees and taking them into camps is akin to what happened to Kenyans during British colonial rule. He said there is no evidence that only Somalis are agents of Al-Shabaab.
I've said that the government has been very high-handed in dealing with this issue, particularly targeting a specific community for profiling. I think that there are better ways of dealing with this matter, but directing investigations just as one community, the Somali community, arresting women, children, and the elderly, and the infirm, and taking them into a camp similar to a concentration camp, and then doing a screening, so much akin to what happened during the colonial time, really has no place in an independent Kenya. We know about Al-Shabaab operating and how it has penetrated our society. There is no evidence that only Somalis are agents of Al-Shabaab.
Human rights organizations and UNHCR are saying that Kenya is in violation of the Geneva Convention. Do you agree that Kenya is in violation of Geneva Convention?
Certainly, yes, because you see, Geneva Convention actually accords refugees rights of tenancy in the country of adoption, and that country is bound to give full protection to the refugees. Now, by arresting everybody who does not have any form of identification and deporting them back to the country where they fled from, violates the provisions of the Geneva Convention. So the fact that somebody does not have an ID should not be a ground for deportation to their country of origin.
Some people are saying that the relationship between Somalia and Kenya is deteriorating. The latest incident that contributed to this, according to them, is the arrest of a Somali diplomat in Nairobi last Friday. He had all his documents. Now, the Somali government called back its ambassador to Nairobi, and the government wants Kenya to apologize in writing. What do you think should be done here, diplomatically?
I think as a country, we need to handle this matter very delicately. It's a very delicate issue, because Somalia is a neighboring country, and the Somali government is a friendly government. We have actually helped to put that government in place. We have deployed a lot of resources. Our people have died, our soldiers fighting for liberation of Somalia from a scourge of terrorism. So it would be very, very unfortunate if the diplomatic relationship between our countries were to break down.
Raila Odinga is Kenya's former prime minister and leader of the Quad opposition. He was speaking with Harun Maruf of VOA Somali Service. A Washington-based democracy advocacy group says media freedom around the world has declined to its lowest levels in a decade, including in places that had been making progress. Freedom House released its annual Press Freedom Report on Thursday. As VOA's Jeff Selden reports, conflicts in Africa led to more violence against journalists.
Conflicts in Africa, like the coup in the Central African Republic, and violence in Kenya, like the terrorist attack at the Westgate Shopping Center, led to new pressures and more violence against journalists. While corruption raised concerns in Uganda, where one newspaper was briefly shut down. But Freedom House says that's only part of the story.
Pretty much every other region of the world showed an overall level of decline, but in Africa, the overall regional average score remained the same, and there were really bright spots, I would say, in a number of countries in West Africa and then in Southern Africa.
Among other positives, the report points to better laws and a growing number of media outlets. Overall, only 3% of sub-Saharan Africans have access to a free media, 14% have access to a partly free media, and 41% live in countries where the media is not free.
That's VOA's Jeff Selden reporting from our Washington studio. It has been more than 2 weeks since gunmen suspected to be from the militant Islamist sect Boko Haram abducted teenage schoolgirls from their dormitory in northeastern Nigeria. Several dozen girls have escaped, but at least 180 are still missing. Their families gathered at the school in Chibok on Thursday to protest against what they say has been a lack of action by authorities and security forces. VOA's Anne Locke has more from Abuja.
The women's sobs were audible over the phone line as VOA spoke to relatives of the abducted girls in Chibok Thursday.
Well, what has happened and nobody care about it. And now our people are crying for the whole world to assist, to help us.
That man's daughter is still missing. He and other relatives, several hundred people in all, they said, were gathered at the grounds of the burned-out secondary school for girls in Chibok. A man named Abba says his sister was among the 275 girls kidnapped from the school on April 14th. He says he wishes the federal government or the military would come talk to the families.
You know, I swear to you, they have never consulted anybody. They have never addressed anyone, apart from the governor that came earlier on. Pleading with the parents to be patient that the daughter will soon be back and all that. The security forces have not gathered all the parents. They have not done anything. They have done nothing. They have just sat down in one area, folding their hands and doing nothing, saying nothing.
Despite a year-long military offensive against Boko Haram, Nigerian security forces have been unable to stop the near-daily violence in the northeast. Relatives of the girls said the government should ask for international help, something authorities have been reluctant to do. The plight of the Chibok girls has become a national cause. Several hundred protesters marched in the rain Wednesday in Abuja to demand the government take, quote, more concrete and visible action to rescue the Chibok girls. Girls are believed to have been divided among several militant camps in the Sembisa forest, near the borders with Cameroon and Chad. A Nigerian intelligence agent in Borno State told VOA that authorities are working to pinpoint which camps. No one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, although it is being blamed on Boko Haram, whose five-year insurgency in the northeast has killed thousands. The militant Islamist sect has been known to kidnap young women for use as servants, spies, and so-called wives. And look, VOA News, Abuja.
Doctors Without Borders say only 20% of people living with HIV in French-speaking West and Central Africa are receiving the antiretroviral drug treatment that they need. This is despite enormous progress made in the fight against HIV/AIDS in Southern Africa, where the disease is more prevalent. Jennifer Lesuta has more from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, MSF, says governments and aid agencies need to do more to help those living with HIV in West and Central Africa. MSF says that despite a relatively low prevalence of HIV in the region, less than 5% of the population, only a fifth of HIV patients who need antiretroviral treatment, ART, receive it. Countless others die before they are diagnosed due to a lack of access to testing. In southern African countries such as Malawi, an estimated 66% of people living with HIV have access to ART. Dr. David Maman is an HIV specialist with MSF. He spoke to VOA from Montpellier, France, where experts are meeting this week to discuss strategies to improve HIV testing and care in Francophone Africa.
In some part of Africa, of Western Africa, you have very few physicians. And in some countries, only physicians are allowed to prescribe ART. So we don't get the same rate of ART coverage than we can get in Eastern and Southern Africa, where the outcomes so far are a bit better.
Maman said that training less qualified health workers, such as nurses, to administer ART has been a successful strategy in other African countries, particularly in rural settings. He said allowing non-physicians to test for and treat HIV not only reaches more people, but frees doctors up for other, more complicated cases. Maman says having free, nearby access to testing and ART is a proven way of reducing HIV transmission. In Malawi, for example, a 2013 MSF-led study found that they were able to reduce the HIV transmission rate to less than 0.5% in selected communities by decentralizing treatment centers and incorporating HIV care into rural clinics. Maman said that similar strategies are also possible in West and Central Africa, but it will take strong political will and significant financial resources. Jennifer Lajuda for VOA News, Dakar.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with chess. A Russian chess legend, Garry Kasparov, arrived in Kampala, Uganda on Thursday to start a major drive to develop chess in Africa. Besides Uganda, Kasparov says he is also keen to set up a similar drives in Tanzania, Kenya, Lesotho, Swaziland, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Turning to rugby, South Africa tackled Portugal as Kenya play Wales at the start of their campaign at the penultimate leg of the 2014 IRB Sevens Rugby in Glasgow, Scotland tomorrow, Saturday. South Africa will also play Samoa and tournament defending champions New Zealand in other Group A fixtures, while Kenya face Fiji, then Argentina. Going into the contest, South Africa is second on the log with 129 points. Kenya is ninth with 60 points, while Zimbabwe is 18th with 1 point. Turning to athletics, the second edition of the Okpekpe International 10-kilometer road race will be contested in Edo State, South Nigeria, tomorrow, Saturday. Kenyan Moses Masai and Georgina Rono are the men's and women's defending champions, respectively. With the backing of the Athletics Federation of Nigeria, the organizers are keen to meet the criteria necessary to secure the IAAF's golden label road race status for the event. Finally, in women's football, Rwanda hosts Zambia in a build-up match in Kigali on Sunday. Both teams are gearing up for the Africa Women's Championship qualifiers later this month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a fabulous weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday. Our listener mail for this Friday morning comes from Ambrose Agio of Makurdi in Benin State, Nigeria. He says, "Dear VOA, permit me to register my warmest appreciation to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on the occasion of his current three-nation tour of Africa. I hope that as he addresses Africa's security problems, Secretary of State Kerry will not relent on the U.S. government offer of counterinsurgency intelligence cooperation with the Nigerian government to reinvigorate the country's fight against the threat posed by Boko Haram extremists." We thank you, Ambrose Agio of Makurdi in Benin State, Nigeria, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. An apparent car bomb killed at least 9 people on Thursday on the outskirts of the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The blast in the suburb of Nyaya was near the site of an April 14 bombing at a bus station that killed at least 75 people. Witnesses say Ethiopian police have killed at least 17 protesters during demonstrations in Ethiopia's Oromia region against plans to annex territory to expand the capital, Addis Ababa. That's it for this Friday, May 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good weekend. Stay tuned for International Edition next. You want to listen to the latest African music? Dance to the best African beat from across the African continent? Then you don't have a problem. Just tune in to the African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time. African Beat, the show that brings happiness into your homes, smiles on your faces. So join me, your host, David Vandy, Monday through Friday, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time on The Voice
of America. Habaki Mondongo, Mwana Mobaliko, Habaki Mondongo, Mwana Mobali, Habaki Mondongo,
African Beats is the best. It's number one. We love it.